One of the things I've learned in the work that I do is that many of us, most maybe, have ideas that we keep coming back to at various points in our lives. Questions that continue to dog us, eluding answers that may satisfy us for long. One of the notions I keep coming back to again and again and again in my thinking is the claim that we're all in this together. So now, as we close our month exploring various facets of justice, I want to offer some reflections on the claim that we're all in this together, lift up some times in which we feel we are, and also pay attention to the times we know we're not. My interest in the question comes from the importance of citizenship I grew up with. Again and again, that lesson was hammered home, rightly so. And maybe it comes from a romantic notion summed up so well in the rallying cry of the Three Musketeers, all for one and one for all. I feel the truth of it, the truth that we are all in this together. When I'm sitting beside someone at their deathbed, because it's in those moments, it is so easy to see not only the specific person in front of me, but also all our futures, mine included. In the last several weeks, I found myself thinking more and more about the ways in which we're all in this together, but also the ways we're not. Because romantic notions aside, we so often act in ways that demonstrate the ways we're not willing or able to be in this together. Often I'm happy to let the incongruity between the two modes be. Other times I find myself looking for rhymes, if not reasons, to explain the two. For better or worse, now is one of the later times. My mother's death last month, I am sure, has played a role in this. Not surprisingly, in many ways, she was the center of my family. She was the one who kept in touch with everyone. Not that I'd recommend the practice, but when we wanted to know about Cousin Jim, we wouldn't call Cousin Jim, we'd call Mom. Like the death of anyone in any family, the loss of her presence has shifted our family dynamic. The center of what was is missing. And while new patterns are just beginning to emerge, things are still quite fluid. The whole is not as strong as it was for so long. Given that, and my hope that yes, we are in all this together, I've been heartened by the moving forward, as you heard earlier from our youth, of the plans for their service trip to New Orleans this summer. And I've also noticed a rise in the number of people offering services or requesting support through our congregation's Community in Challenging Times initiative. We're not always able to match every need immediately, but that people are saying, this I can do and this I need, really shows the strength in the fabric of this faith community. And then came the earthquake in Haiti nearly 3 weeks ago now. If ever a people did not deserve to have it any worse than they already did, it was those folks in Haiti, packed with the devil notwithstanding. I've been impressed by how so many of us here have contributed what we can to the relief efforts. And as I just want you to know, on Friday afternoon, our regional denominational body, the Ohio Meadville District, reported that we and 14 other of our sibling congregations had raised over $21,500 for Haitian disaster relief. And I have to hand it specifically to Jolinda, who on the Sunday after the earthquake arranged to set up her own laptop computer and make it easy for anyone here wanting to contribute to the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee's Haiti Relief Fund. And among many contributions many of you have made privately, our coming of age group held a bake sale last week that brought in over $425 for disaster relief. Way to go, folks. Well done. Well done. This week, on Wednesday night, I listened to President Barack Obama's talk about our need to rebuild trust in our nation during his first State of the Union address on Wednesday night. As he said then, we have to recognize that we face more than a deficit of dollars right now. We face a deficit of trust, that distinction between feeling like we ought to be all in this together and knowing full well we're not. He's right. There is a deficit of trust, although it's going to take much more than any strong rhetoric to fix it. And it was interesting to note in the days since Wednesday that Obama's words have been echoed around the world. Just last night, there was a New York Times article by Allison Smale on the World Economic Forum going on in Davos, Switzerland. And she quotes Obama's chief economic advisor, Larry Summers, telling a packed hall yesterday that, and I'm quoting the article now, although the United States economy grew strongly in the last quarter, persistent unemployment has created a situation he described as, and here Summers is quoted directly, a statistical recovery and a human recession. A human recession. Well, duh. That language is a start in the right direction. That's the sort of thing that happens when the bottom line is profit, not welfare, and when we confuse corporations with citizens. Corporate citizenship is all well and good. I'm all for it. In fact, I could stand to see quite a bit more of it. But I don't think that corporate personhood is what our founders had in mind. I don't think that's what our ragtag forebears were fighting for in the Revolutionary War. And if President Obama's chiding of the Supreme Court Wednesday night lacked subtlety, according to Justice Alito, as he apparently mouthed the words "not true" after Obama's rebuke, at least the president had the courage to call the court out. Let's give him that. Now, here among us, if you've listened to the addresses I've presented over the last year and a half, and you don't even have to be listening all that closely, one thing you will have picked up on is I almost always talk about something I learned from someone while I was traveling. Despite my reading and my study, for some reasons, the lessons that go in the deepest are when I'm encountering people who come from a different culture, who see life so differently than I've been raised to or conditioned to. A conversation I had with a German national some time ago is something I keep coming back to again and again. Clinton was in the White House then, and we were talking about the then new welfare reforms. The person commented that in the U.S. we have what we call welfare. In Europe, she continued, we call it civilization. If I may, ouch. Well, things have certainly changed in Germany in terms of immigration, national identity and culture, not to mention economics since then. Her comments raised the question as to what our society agrees its bedrock responsibility to its citizens are. In many ways, it's a question of balance. But the woman would agree with Rebecca Parker that we cannot turn our bonds from our bonds and obligations for and with one another and expect everything to be okay. Although she might substitute respect for love in Parker's following comments, we need to respect one another at the start, not as an emergency strategy when everything has gone wrong. Because we have to admit it may well all go wrong. Who here today, if you're brave enough, you can do it, raise your hands, regardless of how you normally express your faith, has never, never uttered some version of the line, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." Who hasn't at some point in their life uttered those words or that sentiment? As in our reading earlier about the young boy from New Orleans, at 14, we may wonder for the first time about what's going to happen when everything bad happens at once. But as adults, we have to know a little better. Ronald had seen bad luck before. Houses caught fire. People lost their jobs. Children drowned in the canal. Each time neighbors had given the stricken a bed for the night or a few dollars help, offering strong backs and consolation. This time, though, bad luck had carried its bucket of bitterness through every house on every block, ladling an equal dose to all. How was anybody to rise out of it with nobody left unhurt to lend a hand? Sounds like Haiti to me. Sounds like Haiti. Those things do happen far away and close to home more often than we'd care to admit. These are times when we clearly do need each other, need all the help we can get, actually. When I moved to Berkeley, California to go to seminary, it was 3 years after the 1989 earthquake and just a year after the Oakland Hills fire. One of the things that struck me from the first day of orientation, in addition to the people, classmates, and teachers, was this little plaque that I saw on the wall near the front door to the school. Since then, I've seen many of these in other buildings out in California. The plaque read something to the effect of, "This building is constructed from unreinforced masonry." And then it added something along the lines of, "In the event of an earthquake, duck cover and pray for all you're worth." Something like that. It was not a comforting statement, but it was good to be informed, I guess. With the devastation in Haiti, so much in the news these past weeks, it's good to remember, it really is good to remember, that the worst earthquake that we've recorded in the continental United States wasn't one of those out in California, but a series of quakes registering between 8.1 and 8.3 on the Richter scale that happened between December 1811 and February 1812 in the area around Madrid, Missouri, a town along the Mississippi River, about halfway between Memphis and St. Louis. Four quakes, all above 8.1. Haiti was 7.0, an order of magnitude less strong. Those folks in Missouri weren't expecting those quakes, didn't expect them, but they happened all the same. In fact, according to an uncredited entry on Wikipedia, so take this with a grain of salt or more, 2 years after those quakes, the governor of the then Missouri Territory asked for federal relief for residents of New Madrid County in what might have been the first example of a request made for disaster relief to our government. our new fledgling, I'm sure not terribly rich, government. In our story of Max earlier, that boy from Chile, he reaches out to enlarge his world. He writes a letter and puts it in a package to be sent off to a place he's only dreamed about. And in so doing, he plants the seeds to a friendship that, when tragedy does strike, offers both relief and hope. When the worst happens, knowing that there are folks out there pulling for you, if not reaching out directly, makes all the difference in the world. I find it interesting that the story was published in 2005. And as the pictures suggest that Maggie, Max's pen pal, lived in New York City, we can imagine that Max and his schoolmates would have written to Maggie and sent care packages of their own in the aftermath of September 11th, even though, by all accounts, Maggie and her friends were probably much better off than Max was. No one can afford to presume that he or she will never be in a position to rely on the generosity of others. If we are doing things right, we learn from both mistakes and disasters, those of our lives and those that happen elsewhere. I can only hope that the people and leaders in Haiti take a second look at their building codes in the future. I've heard reports saying that Haiti had no building codes, and others that, yes, there were codes, but they just weren't enforced. I don't know. I simply don't know. No one would confuse Haiti as being a strong state, but there were signs of growth in the last year. How many deaths could have been prevented with stronger construction codes is anybody's guess at this point. But when both their presidential palace and the United Nations headquarters are flattened straight out, you have to think that the answer would be less than we might hope. Any recovery in the weeks, months, and years to come for Haiti will be slow and laborious. They have a long and heart-rending road ahead of them. In the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, President Obama vowed that we would not forsake Haiti because its tragedy reminds us of, and I quote, our common humanity. I hope we as a nation and as generous citizens will do all we can for as long as we can for them there. But other demands will, and even now do, command our attention and our efforts. As commentator George Packer has put it, building a functional Haitian state would be the work of years and require billions of dollars. If this isn't a burden that the international community wants to take on, so be it. But to patch up a dying country and call it a rescue would leave Haiti forsaken indeed, and not by God. Before we close this talking about Haiti, I think it'd be important to bring in a voice from Haiti. A friend brought to my attention an article just a day or two ago in which Edwidge Danicat writes about the death of her cousin Maxo in Haiti when his home collapsed on him. Listen to her account of the conversation she had when she was able to get through to her family. Everyone sounded eerily calm on the phone. No one was screaming. No one was crying. No one said, "Why me?" or "We're cursed." Even as the aftershocks kept coming, they'd say, "The ground is shaking again," as though this had become a normal occurrence. They inquired about family members outside Haiti, an elderly relative, a baby, my one-year-old daughter. I cried and apologized. "I'm sorry I can't be with you," I said, If it weren't for the baby, my nearly 6-foot-tall cousin, the beauty queen we nicknamed Naomi Campbell, who says that she is hungry and has been sleeping in bushes with dead bodies nearby, stops me. "Don't cry," she says. "That's life." "No, it's not life," I say, "or it should not be." "It is," she insists. "That's what it is. And life, like death, lasts only, young Timomon, only a little while. Only a little while." May we be humbled by the courage and clarity of others. May we learn from their experience and their example. May we remain all in this together for as long as we have. Thank you.